Today is Wednesday, March 1st. We're going to be working on articulations today. Okay. So to start off here with articulations, let's do a definition for the word. The word articulations means joint. And when we talk about joints in your body, we not only mean the joints in your elbows, knees, shoulders, and hips, we also mean the joints in your skull that hold your skull bones together, or the joints that hold your teeth into your skull. So articulation means any point where bone comes together with another structure. That may in fact be another bone. It may be cartilage or some other kind of tissue. So we're looking at a type of connection between a bone and something else. That's what an articulation or a joint actually is. I'd like to define two different categories here. We've got functional and structural categories. The functional category explains how movable that joint is. So when I hear the word functional, I want to think, how movable is this joint? And it is sad how movable they are. Okay, so that stands for synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis. And from least movable to most movable, they are sad. Let me explain the terms here. Syn as a prefix means with or together. The suffix arthrosis implies joint. So this is a joint that is grown together. It is not movable. The next level up is an amphiarthrosis. Amphi means on both sides or surrounding. And those are a little more movable because there's typically cartilage involved in those amphiarthroses. And then finally, the most movable joints are called diarthroses. These are the ones that we expect to find in elbows and knees. Those are the freely movable joints. So, from least movable to most movable, synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and then finally the diarthrosis. The structural category explains what the joint is made of, and so some joints are fibrous, meaning they have collagen fibers knitting them together. Other joints are considered cartilaginous, which means there's cartilage holding them together. And the ones we're familiar with are these diarthroses, which are synovial in nature. They have a fluid to help lubricate the bones gliding past one another. Let me make a point here. What I would not do is say all synarthroses are fibrous. I wouldn't say all amphiarthroses are cartilaginous. But I would say this, all diarthroses are synovial. Okay, so I wouldn't necessarily correlate across, except for the last category. All diarthroses are in fact synovial in nature. The other two, kind of tricky. So let's talk about synarthroses first. The word synarthrosis means together joint or with joint. We know that the word synarthrosis is an immovable joint. Let's review. Is the word synarthrosis a functional category or a structural? Functional, right? It tells me that this is a very immovable joint. Notice that it can be categorized structurally as either fibrous or cartilaginous. So fibrous joints are the ones in your skull. Your skull sutures shouldn't be moving. You know, once your head knits together after birth, by age one, your fontanelles or soft spots should have converted to skull sutures. And so those skull sutures remain flexible for a few years to allow for bone growth. But, you know, once you get into adulthood, we see full ossification or calcification, and there's not a lot of flexibility with that expansion of your skull. So those skull sutures are fibrous, meaning collagen fibers help to knit together those skull sutures. So what is a gomphosis?
Teeth.
Teeth, yeah. What is an easy way to remember that?
Gum.
Gum, yeah. So I love it when they hide a clue in the word. A gomphosis is like a gum fossa. That's where your teeth are embedded into your maxilla and mandible, and they're not really meant to be movable. Well, we know that we can move teeth over a long period of time using braces or retainers, but you may know if you've ever worn those things, they take, what, months, years?
And they hurt.
Yes, and they hurt. So you have to wait for osteoblasts to make new deposits of calcium and osteoclasts to destroy the old. So with the case with teeth and skull sutures, they are fibrous in terms of their structural nature and their synarthroses in terms of their functional nature. Let's talk about the cartilaginous joints that are immovable. Now, these joints are called synchondrosis. And if you break the word down, what does the prefix syn tell us?
Together.
And cond?
Cartilage.
Okay, and of course, we're looking for something with cartilage there. This is familiar. This is actually our epiphyseal plate. And that epiphyseal plate is a piece of cartilage between two pieces of bone. This should not move, okay? If you're 5 years old, the last place you want your bones to bend is at that epiphyseal plate. That's not meant to be a flexible joint. This is meant to be a completely immovable joint. So for that factor, it's kind of like a skull suture in that it's not really meant to be a movable joint at all. So our only cartilaginous immovable joint is called a synchondrosis, and this is an epiphyseal plate, growth plate.
That's the only one.
That's the only one. And so if you're an adult, if you're older than, say, 20 to 25 years old, you don't have any of these, right? Okay, so if you're younger than, say, age 20, then it's quite possible you still have these types of joints. But the older you get, the less likely it is to have these joints still visible. Let me repeat. We're talking about synarthroses. That is a functional category. What are the two structural categories that go under this grouping? Fibrous, cartilaginous. Good. Examples of fibrous joints include skull sutures and...
Gomphosis.
That's a fun word to say. Teeth. Okay, and an example of a cartilaginous joint in this category is... Epiphyseal plates. Good. Okay. Let's now talk about amphiarthroses. Amphiarthroses are a little more flexible. They don't have a full range of flexibility, but they're certainly more than what you have with a synarthrosis. Once again, we have two structural types. We have cartilaginous joints and we have fibrous joints. The cartilaginous joints that go in this category are called symphysis joints. You see a lot of sim and syn in this chapter, and that's because that means they're together or with. Now, symphysis joints are ones like we see in the pubic symphysis. And you may think about the way this is set up. At what point would that pubic symphysis need to be flexible?
Childbirth,
yeah. In fact, there's a hormone dedicated to relaxing that pubic symphysis in women, and it's called relaxin. It will literally make your pelvis relax. It'll make those bones spread apart a little bit. And it's actually very painful if a lot of that relaxin is targeting that pubic symphysis at once. Now, if you think about women who are later on in their pregnancy, you know, we all joke about the pregnancy waddle that comes later in pregnancy. That is due to relaxin making that pubic symphysis give way and let those pubic bones kind of spread apart. After birth, relaxin is no longer produced, and so the pelvis should kind of cinch back into its normal position, and women shouldn't have that pregnancy waddle anymore. So pubic symphysis is a great example of a cartilaginous joint that is somewhat movable. Okay? We also have another cartilaginous joint called a symphysis joint, and well, this particular symphysis joint is not in the pubic symphysis. This symphysis joint is in the bones in your back. So your intervertebral discs, rather, are actually symphysis joints. They, too, provide a very small degree of flexibility. If you think about moving your back, you have some degree of movement here, but certainly nothing like what you have with an arm or a leg. So we do have two symphysis joints, the pubic symphysis between the pelvic bones, and then we have here this intervertebral disc, which is a cartilage disc between our spine. All right, and then finally, in our amphiarthrosis joint category, we have a fibrous joint, and this one's called a syndesmosis. Break the word down. That's going to be the easiest way to get this stuff to stick. Syn as a prefix means together. What is desmo? A band. Yeah, it's a band. So these are tendons, ligaments, most likely ligaments because they're binding bone to bone. And this is literally what anchors your tibia and fibula together. It's also what anchors your ulna and radius together. So this banding of fibrous connective tissue is what holds these bones together. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so our last category is the diarthroses, and they're over on page 73. These are meant to be flexible, freely movable joints. They are synovial if you talk about them structurally. And since we've talked about synovial joints in the past, let's review what we know about them. When we discussed membranes, we talked about membranes in these movable joints, and we know that these types of synovial membranes are connective tissues only. There's no epithelial tissues here. What type of fluid is secreted by a synovial membrane? Synovial fluid. And what's the function of that fluid? Good. Lubricate, prevent friction, allow free gliding of those bones and joints past one another. So you've got a more complicated structure for a synovial joint. Well, we've got our two bone ends that are covered by articular cartilage. That's one way to help prevent bone from rubbing against bone. Put that articular cartilage there to act as a rubbery cushion against one bone, literally grinding into another one. Now we have a second thing that helps to reduce friction, and that's the synovial fluid. It acts as a watery cushion between those two bones. So we've got two things so far that help to reduce friction in those joints. We also have fat pads in certain joints. Behind the knee, for instance, has a fat pad. That's yet another way to help cushion those joints. We also have bursa sacs. They're not visible in this picture, but they're little sacs of synovial fluid scattered around this joint, and they're also helping to prevent rubbing and they allow for cushioning of those joints, preventing those bones from rubbing against each other. So I wanted to make the point about the term bursa and bursitis. You ever heard of bursitis before? Okay, somebody may have an elbow that's cranky, rubs together, really stiff and uncomfortable. They may give a steroid shot there to help reduce the inflammation. And so they may say, you've got bursitis in your shoulder. That's an inflammation of the bursa sacs that are contributing synovial fluid to that synovial joint. So if you have excess fluid in these joints, that can be painful and cause stiffness in the joint. Okay, so on your sheet there, let's talk about ligaments and tendons. What do ligaments anchor bones to?
Bone.
Other bones, good. So ligaments anchor bone to bone. And tendons anchor muscle to bone. I had a student many years ago and she came up with a device, so I like to share it. She says that Larry buys books, ligaments bind bone to bone. So LBB for ligaments, bone to bone. Larry buys books. So it's stuck. I like it. I think maybe it'll help you out too. So That's one way to keep straight, that ligaments are bindings for bones. Tendons, however, anchor a muscle to a bone. Just wanted to share with you a couple of issues that happen in these synovial joints, just kind of as an FYI. This is nothing in your course pack, just something I thought you'd be interested to see. We all hear about arthritis, which is an inflammation of what? The inflammation of the joint, right. So as we age, arthritis becomes more of a possibility. We do see a wearing down of the articular cartilages that surround our movable joint ends. And we also see problems with synovial fluid, maybe inflammation or problems with adequate production. You'll notice here in this picture that we have destruction of cartilage, and the real problem comes when osteoarthritis sets in. That's when these bone ends literally can contact and rub against each other. That can cause a breakdown. This is rheumatoid arthritis, and this is an autoimmune disease, which means what is happening? Yeah, your body's being attacked by your own white blood cells. So in this case, autoimmune disease means the white blood cells are attacking the joints. So it can cause disfigurement of our joints, such as these here in the hands. Gout is another type of arthritis. It comes more commonly in males than females. It is something that we see in older populations more so than younger populations. And it has to do with the buildup of uric acid crystals in the joint cavity. So I know we haven't talked a whole lot about what urea is. That's more of a urinary system function. But urea and uric acid come from the breakdown of meat products, especially things like seafood. So if you happen to have a diet where you have a lot of meat or seafood, that can produce uric acid crystals that get into the joints. And imagine salt crystals in there, spiky, rubbing against that joint, being very painful. And some common locations for it are the big toe area, and elbow, you can see the knee there. So these are the parts of the body that are most commonly affected by gouty arthritis. So if you're female, you may never experience this. For those males in our group, this may be something that looms on the horizon. So females are more likely to have rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, so let's talk about the types of movements over on page 74. Do y'all have questions so far? It seems to, yeah.
Okay.
They actually have medication that can help reduce the amount of uric acid crystals in those joints. So if changing the diet doesn't help, there's a medication that can help too.
So when you change the diet, does whatever you have in there, does the uric acid just work its way out eventually? You know what I mean?
The kidneys can excrete more of it and get it out of your system, so it's less likely to accumulate in those joints, cavity spaces.
Okay.
Yeah. Over the counter, they say things like turmeric can also help. So people take mustard and other things of that sort.
I had a doctor tell my husband to drink like cherry juice.
Cherry juice, pickle juice, yeah. Not together.
No. That'd be a nasty combination.
That would be a nasty combination. Okay. Page 74 is a set of motions in synovial joints. I know you guys have probably heard these terms all before in reference to your muscles. So what we're going to think about here is how they work as antagonists. What does it mean if muscles are antagonists?
They work like opposite way.
Opposite way, yes. So you'll notice they're bracketed by antagonist. Everybody on this list but numbers 7 and 8 are antagonists. So that means flexion and extension are opposite actions. So let's start with those two. To flex a joint is to bend the joint. We oftentimes think of bending the elbow, bending the knee. These are flexions. We can also bend at the shoulder joint or even bend here at the hip joint. So to bend is to flex or to decrease the angle between the bones in that articulation. So another word for flexion is to bend. To extend is to straighten. Okay, so to extend is to straighten. So So to bend your arm is to flex it, and to straighten your elbow joint is to extend it. So if you're standing up, your legs are extended at the hip joint, at the knee joint. For those who are sitting, you're flexed at the hip, you're flexed at the knee. I don't know if you've noticed this or not. I know Ms. Floyd mentioned she had pointed it out in lab, but flexors and extensors are on opposite sides of body parts. I know the arms and the legs especially can be awful to learn in terms of muscles, but you may notice that flexors are on one side and extensors are on the other. That can help you out when you're doing like the arm here or even the lower portions of the leg. Okay. Plantar flexion and dorsiflexion are going to be ankle joints only. You'll notice the word flex is in there, so that means we're bending the ankle in some direction. Use the first part of the word as your clue. Plantar flexion means we're planting the foot toward the bottom. We're pushing down, so we're planting our foot. Dorsi means back, so that means we're pulling our toes off the ground and moving them toward our back. So if we stand on our tiptoes, we're doing which action? Plantar flexion, right? Push your toes down, that's plantar flexion. If you stand on your heels and pull your toes up off the floor, now you're performing dorsiflexion, yeah. So that could be an action that you could think about. Our next two are abduction and adduction. AB means away from. I always think of it like this. If somebody's running after me and they want to abduct me, I'm going to run as fast as I can to get away from. Away from. So abduction means to move your body parts away from the midline. You can even spread your fingers apart. That's also abduction. And so if you think about what you did in PE, maybe it was junior high or high school, a lot of the activities they do in warm-up are abduction activities. So jumping jacks, where you move your arms and legs away from the midline and then back forward, those are ab and abduction exercises. So if I have my arms away as an abduction, how do I adduct them? Put them back down, exactly. So I'm adding them back to my midline. So if your legs are spread as if you're doing a jumping jack, when you put them back together, you're adding them back toward the midline. So I normally think of jumping jacks for ab and abduction because that's a great way to illustrate away from and adding back toward. Circumduction, notice, has no antagonistic action, and it's simply a combination of ab and abduction, flexion and extension. I always think of little kids saying, I'm an airplane, and they move their arms in this rotating motion, but this is in fact circumduction. Rotation is another one that has no antagonistic action. Rotation means to move a bone around its longitudinal axis. One great example is to move your head as if you're saying no. You're rotating around the dens, okay? You can also rotate your arm. And with a little bit more effort, you can also rotate your leg. But rotating is to move a bone around its longitudinal axis. Our next two are at the arm or wrist area. They're pronation and supination. So what's an easy way to tell these two apart?
Bowl of soup.
Good. So is that supination or pronation? Supination, good. How can you remember pronation? Pour it out, yeah. Palms are down, P for P. Palms are prone or posterior. So if you're carrying a soup bowl, you're in a supine position with your hands. How do you invert your foot for our next one?
Turn it in,
right? So if you stepped on chewing gum in the parking lot and you turn your leg toward the midline, you're inverting it so that you can look at the sole of your foot. How would you evert your foot?
Turn it outward.
Yep, so to evert your foot is to turn it outward. for those going into physical therapy, you know, a lot of people are prone to inverting their feet, and that's what the most common ankle sprain is. If you fall over your own feet like I've done before, then you sprain your ankle and you basically have turned it under itself. So inversions are more common for ankle sprains than eversions. I found that out through personal experience, unfortunately. Elevation and depression are pretty easy. To elevate a body part is to raise it. Basically, shutting our mouths is to elevate our jawbone. And if your jaw drops open and hard, then of course that's depression. So elevating is to raise the body part. Depression is to lower the body part. Mandible's a great example there. And you're right, shoulders can do it too, right? Elevate your shoulders and depress your shoulders. Last two are protraction and retraction. To protract the body part could be something like your mandible once again. You can put it forward anteriorly, so you can see she's jutting out her jaw. But to retract, it means you're putting it further back than it normally sits in anatomical position. So retraction is to pull it back.
So it's kind of like grinding your teeth?
Kind of like that, yeah. But more exaggerated, I guess you would say.
Sure.
Dorsiflexion and plantar flexion are at the ankle joint. And so if you dorsiflex, you pull your toes up. Yeah, toward the dorsum. And then if you plantar flex, you're pushing your toes down like you're pushing on the gas. So you're planting them toward the plantar surface. So I'm going to let you finish page 75 as a practice page. I did leave you answers on the bottom right-hand side of that page. Okay, so what I'd like to do in our remaining time is get you into the next chapter. This is going to be chapter 10 with the muscular system. So our job's going to be to start off with some basic functions and overall anatomy. I think I left my very important prop at home, but we can certainly review with that when we come back. I've got a straw, a napkin, and paper plate prop that I like to use, but I didn't put it in my book bag to bring with me today. So we'll just go over some basic anatomy, at least lay the foundation for what we discuss after the break. So in terms of skeletal muscle functions, keep in mind, this chapter focuses on skeletal muscles, not cardiac, not smooth. So in terms of skeletal muscle function, we're looking at providing movement of the body by pulling our bones. That's what skeletal muscles do. They pull the bones. Skeletal muscles never push. They can only pull. And so part of our job in this chapter is to figure out how the bones shorten so they can pull those bones. Muscles also help us to maintain our posture against gravity. I'm sure somebody's told you to sit up straight, don't slouch, right? Okay, so it takes good muscle tone to help pull your body up against gravity and work against that downward pull. Interesting thing, you know, they used to show the astronauts come home on the space shuttles, but since they've discontinued that program, you don't get a whole lot of coverage for what's going on in space nowadays. About a year or so ago, Scott Kelly came home from outer space, and you might have seen him land. He had spent a year in orbit on that International Space Station, and when they got him off of the Russian capsule, he was basically, you know, weak compared to what those of us who live here in a gravity environment are. So that demonstrates for us how important gravity is in creating strong bones and muscles, because the muscles pull on the bones. So I believe he told that he couldn't walk on his feet. The bottoms of his feet were so tender and sore for several days. And of course, all that weight that you're not used to putting on your feet now is back to normal. So it was interesting to see how he was responding to life back on Earth in a gravity environment when his muscles and skin, of course, were not used to that environment. So gravity is really important in pulling our muscles and creating strong, healthy bones as well. What's that? I heard, yeah. Imagine.
That's the same thing. Like, I wonder how strong their bones are.
Seriously. Because if they don't have gravity like us, then yeah.
Was he tall?
I think they said he had stretched a little bit, yeah. Because no compression for his spine, yeah. Yeah. Stabilizing joints are an important factor of our muscles. You know, I know you guys have looked in lab at all the tendons and ligaments that hold together shoulders and knees. So those are in conjunction with the muscles that help to stabilize those joints. There's a lot that goes into making a movable synovial joint. This last one is one that I would highlight. It's often overlooked. Generate heat. Being physically active makes your muscles burn ATP to create movements or muscle contractions. So, of course, having muscle heat gives our body some temperature. And now we know the relationship, because if you think back to when we are too hot, what happens to sweat glands? We start sweating. What happens to vessels in our dermis? Vasodilate, right? So we lose more heat to the environment. So anytime those muscles are generating excess heat, we lose that heat to the environment through sweat or through vasodilation. So just want to show the link here between the muscular system and our integumentary system. So muscle tissues are considered excitable. What does it mean to be excitable? Happy muscle tissues, right? Okay, so if you can excite muscle tissue, that means it's able to respond to you. If you have unexcitable muscle tissue, that means it's not responsive to you. And that's not what we want to see.
So, excitability is responsiveness?
Responsiveness, yeah. So let's say somebody's had an injury. Maybe they were riding in a car, had a car accident. The car accident severed a nerve going to the foot. And if we stimulate the foot by saying, hey, I want to move the foot, or we stimulate it with electrodes, if that muscle tissue doesn't respond, we say it's no longer excitable. And so excitable muscle tissue has to be contractile as well in order for us to produce a muscle contraction. You'll notice the next term there is contractility, which means that muscles can shorten upon excitement. When muscles shorten, do they pull bones or push bones? They pull bones, right? So this shortening process is key for making body movements, overall flexions and extensions and so forth.
This is only going to pull.
Only going to pull, that's right. And for the last term there, I want you to think about underwear. Good underwear is elastic. Bad underwear has lost its elasticity. Goes in the waste can, right? Okay, so if it's lost its elasticity, you stretch it and it stays stretched. Even when you let it go, it stays all flabby and stretched. Healthy muscle tissue, you stretch it, and when you let go, what happens? Sucks back in, yeah. Pops back to its original shape. So that recoilability is what we want with muscle tissue. If you have strong, healthy muscle tissue, when you stretch it, it pops back with great strength. Okay, so that elasticity is going to be key for having strong muscle contractions. About midway down your page, you've got three types of muscle tissue. Can you tell me which one is smooth muscle?
The middle one,
yeah. Middle one is smooth muscle. How about the far left?
Right here.
Cardiac, how did you know?
Intercalated
discs, good. And of course, by process of elimination, the one on the right is
skeletal.
Yep. So since we've talked about those three muscle tissue types before, I'd like to move you on to the next page. How about questions so far? The worst one.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like riding a bike. I don't want to scare you. If you get the hang of it, and muscle contraction is like a story that you can tell, and if you can tell a story to somebody, you're good. But for some people, they get their training wheels stuck on, and they can't get the training wheels taken off, and that's where the grades go down. But yeah, if you can practice the story, that's a good place to be. Okay, so what I'd like to do is talk you from the macro anatomy of a muscle down to the micro anatomy of that muscle. Looks like I lost a little piece of my... Let's get all of those. Okay. Starting on the top of the page, the macroscopic anatomy is something you can see with the naked eye. The covering or membrane wrapping on the entire outside of your muscle is called the epimyceum. I've also heard it pronounced epimysium. So we're going to talk about food for just a minute because it's about lunchtime, right? Okay, so if you've ever had, say, maybe a pork roast or a beef roast or something like that, you may notice that on the outside there's a kind of a shiny wrapping, and then you may notice that when you cook it, that shiny wrapping kind of falls off and it looks like just this papery-like membrane. You may never have noticed it before. They may have actually taken that off before they packaged that meat. But if you do find a wrapping on the outside, that's most likely the epimyceum, which is a wrapping or covering around that muscle tissue. Think about biceps brachii. If you were to pull that muscle up, it would have a wrapping around the outside. That's the epimyceum for that muscle, okay? So if you were to look inside, let's go back to your beef roast or pot roast again. You may notice that when you pull that meat apart, there's these long strings of fibers. Those strings or fibers are actually muscle fibers. And you're actually getting to get a sense of how that muscle is constructed in the macroscopic view just by pulling apart, say, something like barbecue or pork roast. Now, if we were to look inside with a microscope, we would actually see that there are these coverings around these groups of muscle fibers. These individual wrappings are called the perimyceum. So I'm going to circle a few here. This is another perimyceum here. And there's another perimyceum, and yet another perimyceum.
I have one question.
Sure.
On the bone part, are you pointing to the entire outside or just that line?
The entire outside, all of this stuff. Yes, so epimyceum is that entire outer covering. Inside the perimyceum, you'll notice there are a bunch of circular-looking things. Those are, in fact, muscle cells, otherwise known as muscle fibers. So a bundle of muscle cells is wrapped up by the perimyceum, okay? And those bundles are called fascicles. So this perimyceum is the wrapping around the bundle of muscle cells. The bundle itself is called a fascicle. Perimysium is a wrapping, and the wrapping goes around a bundle of muscle cells, and the bundle is a fascicle. That's just an alternate name for a bundle. So at this point, you're starting to lose macroscopic stuff that you can see with your naked eye. Because when we transition to the muscle cell itself, we're now looking at a microscopic structure. So now we start needing a microscope to aid us in our view. When we get to the muscle cell, you'll notice that I've drawn already a little border around the outside of that muscle cell. There's also a sleeve, just like a long sleeve, that covers and wraps each one of our individual muscle cells. So I'm just going to color that in like it's a sleeve. And that endomysium or endomysium is a sleeve or a wrapping around that individual muscle cell.
So we haven't actually said number three yet.
We are at number three yet. Hold on, let me see. Two is perimysium, three, each individual muscle cell is wrapped by endomysium, so yeah, three is endo. Okay, so do you see the trend here in the naming scheme? Epi, outside or upon, peri is around, endo, of course, is the innermost wrapping. So I've got a little visual that I'd like to bring. I didn't know I was going to get this far today with the material, but I'll bring that with me so we can actually walk through it again. But there's a way we can play with straws and napkins and paper plates that actually give us a visual for how this stuff is arranged.
Before you go on.
Sure.
I'm stuck in perimysium.
Perimysium, okay.
Okay. So I know that one little thing is perimysium, but all of them are called
fascicles. Well, let me put it to you this way. I'm going to go out in the woods and I'm going to pick up sticks. And I have my arms full with a bundle of sticks. And I'm dropping sticks and I'm walking as clumsily as I can. And I've got this bundle in my arms. The bundle is the fascicle. And you come along and you say, hey, why don't you take this bag and put all these sticks in the bag? Now the bag is going to wrap up all my sticks, and that's the perimysium.
Oh,
okay.
Everything that's inside of it.
Yeah, the fascicle is just another name for the bundle that we're wrapping up. Okay, yeah, and the perimysium is the wrapping.
Yeah.
And that visual.
I have a bundle of firewood at the grocery store. If you're ready to do that, that's perfect for what you're saying.
Yeah.
So the bundle of wood is the fascicle, but the shrink wrap around it is the perimysium.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
I was thinking back about that.
That would work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Or even put spaghetti in a box. Those spaghetti noodles are your muscle cells, and the box is your perimysium. So there's your assignment for the grocery store, right? Find something that suits this. Okay, so what I'd like to do is take you into the microanatomy for just a moment. Before we get there, before I forget, I do want to mention these two terms. When you signed up for A&P, you didn't realize it was going to be a complete foreign language course, but it really is. So these two terms here, tendon and aponeurosis, are actually connective tissue pieces that anchor muscles to muscles or muscles to bone. So I did want to mention them because they're part of our conversation. They're actually pieces of endo and perimysium that anchor together different muscles. The greatest one we can use as an example in terms of an aponeurosis is what's on your scalp. So the aponeurosis connects your frontalis muscle to your occipitalis muscle in the back. Some textbooks even call it the fronto-occipitalis muscle. They think it's all one continuous muscle, just divided by that sheet of connective tissue. So kind of a cool concept there. What do tendons anchor muscles to?
To bones,
yes. So these are basically pieces of endo and perimycium that kind of separate away from the muscle and do some kind of connection job. Okay. Do you have questions on these terms so far? Okay, aponeuroses and tendons are pieces of endo and perimycium that kind of, they leave the muscle, and what you've got here is just connective tissue. It was part of the muscle, but it kind of did its own thing, and so it's actually going to connect that muscle to either a bone and call it a tendon, or it connects that muscle to another muscle, and now we call it an aponeurosis. So it depends on what you're connecting the muscle to. Right, ligaments is bone to bone.
Tendons is bone, muscles to bone.
Muscles to bone.
Muscle to muscle.
Muscle to muscle, that's right. Okay. This is not the blank for the bottom of the page. I just want to tell you that up front. I just want to give you some working terminology here. We use the words muscle cell and muscle fiber interchangeably. And the reason for this has to do with the body's growth and development. Muscle cells are normally very tiny, but think about rectus femoris in your leg. It has to travel from your knee joint to your hip joint. That's quite a long distance, over a foot in most of our bodies. So to travel that far, we actually have various muscle cells joined together, and that's why skeletal muscle appears to be multinucleate. So when you have a multinucleate cell, we actually don't want to call it a cell so much because it implies there's just one there, but we in fact have a fusion of cells. So the term muscle fiber may be more appropriate since it's lots of cells that have linked together and joined to make this really long structure. Long story, the short point here is muscle cell and muscle fiber refer to the same thing. We've heard the word plasma membrane before, but when we talk about muscles, the plasma membrane specifically is called a sarcolemma. Now, that is number one on the bottom of your page, sarcolemma. Okay, bottom of the page, yeah, flesh husk is sarcolemma. And we know cytoplasm is the fluid and solutes inside your cell, but we're going to have a specific name for muscle cytoplasm. We're going to call it sarcoplasm. So that next blank right under number one there is sarcoplasm.
We didn't have enough names.
No, you didn't have enough words. You need more. You need two and three words for everything. Yep. Okay, so notice the trend. Sarco means flesh. It technically refers to muscles. So let me show you how the muscles' plasma membrane works.
Are we on number two or is this
just number two? We're not quite to number two.
Okay, so sarcoplasm.
Yeah, sarcolemma is the number one blank, and right underneath it, sarcoplasm. Okay, so still at number one, if you read along there, you'll notice something called a transverse tubule, or a T-tubule for short. I want to show you, this is actually how the plasma membrane on the muscle cell works. There are these intersections that looks like a T that dives deep into the muscle to carry the nerve impulse down to all those muscle cells at once. So if you imagine that this is my muscle cell right here. Okay, and here perhaps is another muscle cell and so forth. There are indentations of the plasma membrane that sit like T's that send the nerve impulse deep into the muscle cell so we can send the message to all these muscle cells at once. So these will all have these T-shaped intersections. They're called T-tubules or transverse tubules, and they're important for carrying nerve impulses deep into our muscle tissue. Probably not this one. You mean like on test day? Yeah, not this one. I'd more likely put that one on there, and then we're gonna do another one probably after break that you'll have on there. Okay, so let's talk about number two. There are tiny organelles inside of your muscles. You've heard about mitochondria, you've heard about rough ER, but here's a new one for us. Number two is myofibril. Long, skinny, contractile organelle inside our muscle cells. Hey, did everybody get the sign-in sheet today? Okay. So each myofibril is wrapped by its own little sleeve, and this sleeve is called a sarcoplasmic reticulum. That name should sound familiar, right? Okay, so you've heard of an endoplasmic reticulum. This sarcoplasmic reticulum means I am in the muscle cell, there's that sarco prefix, and I wrap the myofibril. Here's what you want to know about the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It stores calcium. Okay, so here's what you want to know about the SR. It stores calcium.
So sarcoplasm stores calcium and wraps the myofibril.
Yeah, that's right. Stores calcium and wraps the myofibril. It wraps the myofibril, the SR wraps the myofibril, and it stores calcium. Let me tell you where we're heading. When you come back from break, we're going to do a brief overview of what we've just been through, but I'm going to start you on page 79 to label that picture. If you've never seen that before, it's worth a look ahead either in your course pack or your textbook. There's a labeled version on page 80 with an explanation on page 81. Where we're heading on Monday after the break is to page 83. We're going to walk through muscle contraction, which is a few pages, and we're going to do it numerous times until you get the swing of it. Okay, so if you've got time to look ahead, that's where we're heading. Y'all have a great spring break.